Well, morning, folks. Thanks very much again for the invitation to come and take the service this morning, or this afternoon, rather. I'm going to read you just one verse from the Bible, and it's from Hebrews chapter 11. Now, you all well know that passage and how it's about the faithful people of the Old Testament and how it's sometimes called the art gallery of faith. But the one verse I'm going to read is a kind of odd verse. At least it struck me as odd. It's odd because, when you read that chapter, you discover that most people get more verses. For example, Abraham gets 10 verses, and Moses gets 6 verses. But when you come to Joseph, he only gets one verse. And it's odd for another reason, because the others, it's all about their lives and what they did. But Joseph, it's Joseph's last words. And it's really about what's going to happen after he dies. So here's the verse that we're going to read this morning. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. Really quite strange. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Israel, from Egypt, and gave instructions about his bones. Joseph's last words. Now, last words can be significant. We all kind of regard them that way. Even in the natural sense, we think about people's last words as being important. We think especially important the last words of a mother or a father. We say sometimes, you know, the last thing my father said to me before he died. And then the law recognizes the significance of last words. In this country anyway, a dying declaration. If somebody knows they're about to die, their witness is taken as especially significant. It's taken as expressing the truth. And then sometimes last words can be revealing, revealingly true. I remember my own grandfather's last words sometime in the 1960s. And exactly like Joseph, he gave instructions concerning his bones. He said where he wanted to be buried. And it came as a great surprise to me that he wanted to be buried in Alexandria. Who wants to be buried in Alexandria? Don't know if you've been to Alexandria recently. It seemed a strange request. You see, he came from a little island off Skye called Rasi. There's only about 100-odd people live in it now. But that was the scene of his childhood, the place that he knew best, you might say. And I had thought you might have wanted to be buried there in the little churchyard dedicated to the Celtic saint, St. Molag, with a beautiful view over the Sound of Rasi towards Skye. Or I thought perhaps he might have wanted to have been buried in the town of Kirkintilloch, where he had lived for 50 years and his family had been brought up. But no, he wanted to be buried in Alexandria. And it was only then that I discovered that there was something deep down that I didn't know about him. A scar that had been concealed, perhaps even a scar that was unhealed after 50 or 60 years. For although my grandmother and grandfather had 9 children, their first child had died in infancy and been buried in Alexandria. So when it came to his last words, he said something that was revealingly true. Was there something revealingly true about Joseph's final words, something deep down? Or was he just simply thinking of home, of the scenes of boyhood, of life when it was young and full and free and energetic? You might have noticed that about people, how they tend to think back to their teenage years. There seems to be something formative about that time of life, when our outlook and our character is formed. I notice it myself when I go back to Kirkintilloch, where I was brought up, to funerals usually nowadays. Used to be weddings. But when you meet your cousins, with a large number of cousins, when you meet your relatives, instantly you're back with them at the time that you were when they were your big cousin or your wee cousin. And it seems as if the rest of life's not so important. You spend 30 years in a place, and the people you work with when you retire or they retire, they're out of your ken almost totally. But when you return to the scenes of your childhood, there's a reality, a relationship there. Was that all that was in Joseph's words, a desire to return to the scenes of his childhood and youth? By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. Or was there something more to it than that? Was there something surprising about Joseph's ambition, about Joseph's perspective? Well, It was certainly surprising compared to the other patriarchs, the other people described in that chapter. You remember Noah. The big thing about him was that he built an ark, and he saved his family from the flood and all the animals too. By faith, Noah, when he was warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. And then when we come to Abraham, just to take another example, by faith, Abraham, when he was called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. The big thing about Abraham was that he obeyed the command of God. And he left the city-state of Ur with all its civilization and became a nomad and set out for the promised land with all that that meant for the future of his family and for the world. It's odd then to read the verdict of Hebrews 11 on Joseph. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instruction about his bones. Was this the big thing about Joseph? If so, it's surprising. Joseph's surprising ambition. You see, my perspective on Joseph would have been different. If I had been writing Hebrews 11, I would have written about Joseph's achievements. I would have said, by faith, Joseph became the second most powerful man in the world, and that by the age of 30. He became something like the equivalent to the President of the United States today. He was the Prime Minister of Egypt, the biggest superpower of its age, the leader of a society at the peak of human achievement and civilization, the leader of a society and a civilization which is in fact to this day the longest lasting civilization the world has ever known. Or I might have spoken about the big success of Joseph in that job. I might have said, by faith, Joseph saved the Egyptians and the surrounding nations from starvation. You'll remember the story about Pharaoh's dream and the 7 fat cattle and the 7 thin cattle and the 7 good years and the 7 bad years, and how Joseph interpreted the dream and stored up food in the good years for distribution in the bad years. A big achievement. You might even say governments today could learn a little from Joseph. Or alternatively, I might have spoken about Joseph's character. I might have said, by faith, Joseph was a man of great insight, so that he could interpret dreams and foretell the future. You remember the incident of the baker and the cupbearer in the prison, and how they had dreams, and how Joseph foretold the future, and it came true. One was restored to office, and the other was executed.
Or I might have said that by faith Joseph was a man of great moral integrity, a man of faithfulness. You remember how he was the chief steward in the household of Potiphar, the powerful civil servant, that Potiphar's wife attempted to seduce Joseph and met with rejection, resulting in a false accusation of attempted rape and Joseph's eventual imprisonment. By faith, Joseph was a man of great moral integrity. Or I might have gone on to say, by faith, Joseph was a man of great magnanimity. You remember how his brothers sold him into slavery, and how when they met again and Joseph was the dictator of Egypt and these supplicants looking for supplies from his warehouses, there's no hint of revenge and not even a word of reproach. Here's what Joseph says. I am Joseph, your brother whom you sold into slavery in Egypt. But don't be upset and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me to this place. It was God who sent me ahead of you to preserve your lives. But in the end, in Joseph's last moments, none of these seem important. Neither his achievements nor his character. The verdict of faith, the verdict of God, the verdict of Joseph is none of these. Here it is. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instruction about his bones. You see, Joseph seems to have had a different perspective, a different take on things, a different ambition, and it's profoundly surprising. For although he was a man of distinction, a leader of men, a statesman of the first order, perhaps the most powerful man in the world at that time, his values were different, and they were different from the values of the culture in which he served. They were different, you might say, from the dominant worldview of his time. I wonder if you ever thought that the dominant worldview, the worldview of the majority, can be wrong. For example, if you had lived in Russia in 1950, you would have had a certain dominant worldview. You would have thought that Marshal Stalin was the greatest man who had ever lived and that he was the creator of a great civilization. And if you lived in Germany in 1938, you would have thought that Adolf Hitler was a great man, the saviour of his people, somebody who had brought prosperity and the abolition of unemployment and peace and security to his nation. And if you'd lived in the United Kingdom, in this country, in 1843, you would have thought that it was wrong to send relief supplies to the starving thousands in Ireland, because the dominant worldview was that to do that was to upset the economics of the time. It's obvious that the worldview of the majority can be wrong. I wonder if you ever thought that the dominant worldview of our culture in this time could be wrong in some things. I wonder if you ever thought it could be wrong about its idea of our existence. The dominant worldview of our society at the moment is that we are here by accident, that there's no reason for our existence, that we have no purpose other to enjoy ourselves here and not to worry about God. The dominant worldview of our society at this time is that the abortion of the unborn child is reasonable on almost any grounds, that the fetus has no rights of its own. The dominant worldview of our society at this time is that gay relationships are equivalent to heterosexual ones and are to be regarded as equivalent, I wonder if you ever thought that the dominant world view of our time could be wrong. Just because an idea is modern doesn't mean that it's correct. Just because a belief is what we believe in this day and age doesn't make it true. Just because everybody thinks this nowadays doesn't make it dependable. Some of the dominant worldviews of the United Kingdom in 2010 could be wrong. You see, Joseph had an alternative worldview. So what was Joseph's alternative worldview? Well, it was basically this, that there was something more important than Egypt. At a personal level, there was something more important than being president. When we go to Genesis 10, we read Joseph's actual words. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised in oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, "God will surely come to your aid. Then you must carry my bones up out of this place." So Joseph died at the age of 110. And after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. It had something to do with leaving Egypt. Joseph's different view, different ambition, different perspective had something to do with leaving the scene of all his triumphs. It had something to do with the Exodus. "God will come to your aid," he says. "He will bring you up out of here." He knew the promises and purposes of God. What God had promised and purposed in Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them a promised land. And more than that, he foresaw and saw ahead to the blessing that would come to the whole world through that people and eventually through the Saviour. And he gave commandment about his mortal remains. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instruction about his bones. Joseph did not have in view the Westminster Abbey of his time, the place where the famous of our land, the poets, the scholars, the warriors are buried, is Westminster Abbey. But Joseph did not have in view for him the Westminster Abbey of his time. For himself, he had in view the promised land. For himself, he had in view the promises of God. For himself, he had in view the purposes of God and all that God would do in the future. Joseph was really saying, "I have confidence in God and his promises." And he regarded these as more important than Egypt and all that he had done there. But there was something more to it than that. You see, I think it had something to do with this place called Shechem. That's eventually where Joseph was buried in Joshua chapter 24. The clues are in the Old Testament story. So what was special about Shechem? Well, I think Shechem spoke about a place of permanent settlement. Joseph knew the Old Testament stories that had gone before him. And he knew that Shechem was a place of security. You see, in Genesis chapter 12, when Abraham responded to God's call to leave Ur of the Chaldees and go to a land that was promised to him and receive God's blessing, we read that Abraham travelled through the land as far as Shechem. Shechem was the first place where Abraham pitched his tent in the promised land, the first place of settlement, the place where God said to Abraham, to your offspring will I give this land. So when Abraham landed there, when Abraham arrived there and pitched his tent for the first time, he no longer became a wandering nomad. Now he had a land, not yet in full possession, but in promise. I think he could say to himself, I've made it. When he left Ur of the Chaldees, day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, pitching his tent in another place. A place that was impermanent, a place that was transient, asking himself, will this be the place? But when he comes to Shechem, God says to him, to your offspring will I give this land. I think he could have said, I've made it. I'm here. The journey's over. I can rest after years of insecurity, never knowing the next campsite, something settled, something, a future to look to. Security at last. Peace at last, a place of security. But Shechem was more than that to Jacob. It was to Abraham. It was a place of secure relationship with God. We read further. Not only that he pitched his tent, not only that God said to him, I will give you this land, but these words. So Abraham built an altar there to the Lord, who had appeared to him for the first time in the promised land, the first time since leaving Ur of the Chaldees, he built an altar and worshipped the Lord who had appeared to him. For the first time in the promised land, he's able to worship God, to reestablish a right relationship with God, a place of secure relationship with the God who had appeared to him. But then, as we move on in the story to Joshua chapter 24, and Jacob is buried at Shechem, we find that it's also there a place of secure relationship with God. You'll recall that we're after the Exodus, and we're after the 40 years of the desert, and we're after the conquest of the promised land, and the people come to Shechem. And Joseph gathers the people of Israel there, and he reviews their history, and he challenges them, and here is what he says. Then Joshua assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem, and they presented themselves before the Lord. And Joshua said, now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and for my household, we will serve the Lord. And Joshua renewed the covenant. The agreement between God and his people was renewed there at Shechem, and they worshipped God. He reestablishes a right relationship with God. So for Abraham before them in Genesis chapter 12, and for Joshua and the people in Joshua chapter 24, Shechem is the place of secure relationship with God. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. He was saying, there's something more important than Egypt. There's something more important than the president, being president. There's something more important than preventing the famine. There's something more important than all that I was and all that I did in Egypt. And in a sense, Joseph was unfulfilled by all of that. And in a sense, Joseph was disappointed with all of that. And he's looking for security, and he knows that it's only to be found in the God of Abraham,